She's not wearing anything fancy, just her blue jumper and a peach blouse and black flats from work. Then Senator Henry Bonwiller arrives, and for some reason she's thrilled enough just to stare outright at him. He's standing in a small group of older gentlemen near the stage, talking to this one and that, gesturing with his large hands at all kinds of comers and goers, and when his eye falls on hers for a moment, then goes on, then comes back. She blushes and turns away. He knows I don't belong.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Ethan Cannon's new novel is called America, America, and it takes on power, politics, and class in a small upstate New York town. It's set in the early 1970s, and it's Cannon's sixth book. Ethan Cannon left the famous Iowa Writers' Workshop 20-some years ago after producing only a handful of stories. He went to medical school at Harvard, where he managed to write an extraordinary collection of short fiction called Emperor of the Air. He dropped out, traveled, went back to medical school, and worked as a doctor before choosing to write full-time. Now Cannon teaches at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the same program he left in defeat so many years ago. This reading of America, America took place in July 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
It's a delight to be here. This is only my second reading, and I've been looking forward to this one because this is Washington. This is a political book. But this book did not start out at all as a political book. It was just a small story about a kid who jumps classes, about a working class kid. And it started with a scene on a sailboat in which this kind of working class kid is in on a fancy sailboat, and the girl drops herself overboard. And that was the first scene that started this book. And I wrote a whole book, and I sent it into my editor. She said, okay, we'll publish it. This was in 2003. She said, cut about 100 pages from it, and we'll publish it. So she sent it to me. I added about 400 pages. a senator entered it. He became a presidential candidate. That was all not in the original draft. You know, books for me have always been that way. It's just their explorations in the dark. I've read in a couple of reviews now, people say he's made an attempt at an epic novel, which is I'm flattered by that, but it was a complete surprise to me. Just writing the same thing I've always done, just adding a guy who runs for president, which is partly because I'm a political hound. I live in Iowa. So boy, do we get it early on. And this book was about 3.5 years late. And there turned out to be some prophetic things in this. I mean, this candidate makes a speech about the bridges of hope. You know, long before I'd heard of Barack Obama. And there's a sexual scandal in it. And can you believe there are sexual scandals this year in politics as well? I'm going to read a little bit. And I'd love to just talk and answer questions and chat with people. This is both a personal book and a political book. And I couldn't decide really which it was as I was writing it. So in some ways, it's both. It's a personal story and a political story. I'll tell you a couple of things. It's narrated by a young man whose name is Corey Sifter. And he's a young man when most of the events of the story take place, a blue-collar guy in a town in western New York. In fact, my old friend from medical school is here, whose house I once visited up in sort of upper New York State. Or it turns out it was in Canada, but I thought it was in New York State. And that was sort of the impetus for that milieu. And Updike, in his review in The New Yorker, said he was something like, he has the eye of a native about this landscape, which is interesting because I actually have never been there. Except for that one moment when I was in Canada. I thought until today that it was New York. My friend told me it was Canada. There's a guy who writes the Washington City paper with a Greek last name, who I wrote a very nice or perceptive, I thought, review of this book and said what I had always thought it was about, which is a man who's trying to decide whether it's a young man who is brought up in the world by a very wealthy New York State family, a blue-collar boy who's given a leg up. He's sent to boarding school. This family is a kingmaker family. And this guy has said the book boils down to whether he's trying to think back on whether this was a gift or a piece of manipulation. That is exactly right. And that's how I thought of the book, as this man trying to decide whether he'd been given something by this family or used by this family. It's always been a question I've been interested in. What is that exactly? And that's what this book asks, in a way. And doesn't answer and doesn't attempt to answer, but asks. And something bad happens during this political campaign. And the man, as an adult now, is remembering his part in it as a teenager. One day 6 years ago, a few weeks after our oldest daughter had headed back to college, I realized I'd only thought of this from Henry Bonwiller's point of view. Henry Bonwiller is the senator who runs for president. Our daughter was at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York, and in mid-October, my wife and I and the two younger girls went up for a visit. We arranged to meet at a coffee shop close to campus. I was just parking the car when I looked up and saw Andrea emerging from the rust-colored trees, carrying her books in one of those leather schoolboy straps out of a French movie that are popular again with college kids, wearing blue jeans and a light-colored blouse that looked a little too thin for the weather. You can imagine how that felt. There was still a touch of summer in the air, but not much. She paused before crossing the street, then proceeded just ahead of a couple of bicyclists and an old VW Beetle looking for a parking space. And I must say, watching her walk out of those trees like some creature of the forest, out into the main avenue of businesses where the cafes and clothing stores and antique shops were doing a brisk commerce, and students and families and groups of businessmen in suits with their cell phones out were filling up most of the narrow sidewalk, I was struck with such a feeling of tenderness that I nearly broke down. I guess that in my years with the Metairies that's the family of kingmakers in Western New York State. I guess that in my years with the Metairies, I was too caught up in Henry Bonwiller's hopes to think of it from any wider view. Joellen Charney was only in her 20s when it happened. I've spoken to plenty of people about it over the years. Understandably, it's not a rare topic of conversation up here even now. Some of the details are known, but even these have been sketched and resketched in barber's chairs and grocery lines. Some of the conjecture random and innocent, and some of it, I think, not. Most of it, to this day, remains a mystery. They met, I think, at a fundraising function. It's sometime in mid-May, all the trees in bloom and that feeling in the air. A luncheon to raise money for one of the causes her family has probably never heard of, the preservation of the local streams and woodland, which her father doesn't have the money or the inclination to give to, even though he likes to hunt. He's a working man, operates a 45-ton crane for Harburg Shrewsbury. Her mother's a secretary at an elementary school south of Buffalo and a regular at church. Joellen is the first to have gone to college, and she's made some friends there with ambitions. Maybe she has ambitions, too. She's not sure. When she won the Miss Three Counties pageant, she had to sing Danny Boy to beat a prettier girl from Fredonia. And for a few months, this has given her some kind of boost and made more of her old friends interested in her again. She's had boyfriends, but she's never thought of herself as any kind of beauty. So she's been riding just a little high. Still, she's a plain girl at heart. She's been invited by one of these girlfriends to this fundraiser luncheon and is nervous and slightly confused to be there in the Elks Hall, finally, where she knows nobody else, and which has been set with rented tables and plastic flower arrangements in oversized vases. She's not wearing anything fancy, just her blue jumper and a peach blouse and black flats from work. Then Senator Henry Bonwiller arrives, and for some reason she's thrilled enough just to stare outright at him. He's standing in a small group of older gentlemen near the stage, talking to this one and that, gesturing with his large hands at all kinds of comers and goers, and when his eye falls on hers for a moment, then goes on, then comes back. She blushes and turns away. He knows I don't belong. She takes a couple of steps towards the punch bowl and makes a distracted effort with a plastic cup, and when she turns around again, he's still looking at her. He makes a little nod and a half smile. The next day, it's her girlfriend again who calls to say that the two of them have been invited to another event. Invited. It's a speech the senator is giving up in Morrison, more than 50 miles away. She chooses the red dress this time, the short-skirted one she sewed herself for Miss Three Counties. It has a trace of gold thread that shimmers in the fabric, and she probably shouldn't, but she does. Well, why not? They borrow her girlfriend's brother's car, a Camaro with leather seats, and drive up to the college auditorium where the senator makes a speech about water rights and the urgent need to enforce the new anti-pollution laws. And she listens so carefully she can quote the statistics back to him later when they run into each other by accident in the parking lot near her car. He says, "Nice to know someone was listening." All she can do is blush. A few days later, she's called at her own apartment by one of his aides. This time, he says, "Don't bring your friend." This is about 20 pages later. Her first meeting with the senator is at a nightclub in Habsburg, 30 miles away. She doesn't tell her friend about it this time, and this time she takes her own car instead, a white Gremlin that she washes and vacuums and fits with an air freshener before she leaves. She brings three minis of vodka to calm herself. She has one in her driveway and the second followed by a breath mint just before she gets to the club where she finds him waiting for her in his car in the lot. Of course, it's a caddy. They never go into the building. They drive around instead, and he's friendly and calm and authoritative, not as formal as she thought a senator would be, telling her about the rock mines that used to be in these hills and the possibility that IBM would be coming up here to build a plant on the old site. Then they come out on a reservoir, and he stops the car. It's a warm night, and it's a convertible, but he doesn't open the top. She wouldn't want him to. But he takes a flask from the glove box and offers her some, which she takes even though she's had the two minis already. And then he takes a little himself. This is a senator sitting across the seat from her. He has a wife. She's looked it up. "Sing Danny Boy," he says softly. Well, how did he know that? But when she's finished, she's almost sure his eyes are wet. And think how that feels. He moves across the seat and half sings, "The summer's gone and all the roses falling," himself in that voice that might as well be coming out of the radio. It's so honey-colored where it plays in the lower registers. She adds the harmony. "You're good," he says. "They teach you that in Optimist Chorus? How'd you hear about that?" "A little bird told me." It all feels like a bubble she's watching glint in the sun. She doesn't have the last mini until she's driving home. After that, they meet a few more times for rides like this, usually with a stop at the end at a motel, and soon they give up the rides and just start meeting at the motel. She drives the Gremlin. Mostly it's a place called the Pines, a set of hideaway cabins in a grove off the road near Islington. He arrives an hour or two later in various different cars, and sometimes now he has a driver with him. She can see him through the slit in the shades, a tall Negro in a chauffeur's cap, half sleeping, 5 feet from their window. There's always something to drink, either scotch whiskey or wine, and he likes to bring a sandwich with him and eat it when they're finished, even though she never has anything herself. At this point, she still can't imagine eating in front of him. Then there's a day, maybe 3 weeks into it, when he says to her, "That bastard Leftwich is going to run for my seat." When she looks it up later, she can't figure out how to spell the name, but she gathers her nerve and asks the librarian. Louis Lefkowitz is the Republican Attorney General of the state, and sure enough, she starts seeing his name in the paper. She starts seeing it all the time. New York Attorney General Louis Lefkowitz, and it's a funny thing, but she feels like she has an enemy now. The surprise is that she likes it. After that, Henry Bonroller starts talking to her about all kinds of things, about who's going to get money for a shopping center project and who's going to be indicted, about what the teachers' union is going to get in their new contract, and about remodeling Kennedy Airport for some new kind of superplane. And he stops asking her to sing. He does his talking when he first arrives, pacing back and forth in the little motel cabin as though he's trying to walk and talk his way from one world into another. She lies on the bed, listening carefully. After a while, he sits down next to her and has another drink. Then he reaches up and loosens his tie by yanking it. Right after he's climaxed, he has a habit of falling asleep, but only for a few minutes. When he wakes up, he eats his sandwich, gets dressed, and goes. Once the driver had to knock on the window, he had a vote in the Senate in the morning. Then comes the day he tells her he's thinking of something big. Later, after he's dressed, he says he's not just thinking it, he's going to do it. "What?" she says. "Be president." President of the United States? It slips from her mouth before she can stop it, like a dog running out the door. But he laughs. He thinks it's charming. "No, president of the Choral Society," he says, and takes her hand to swing her around in a little jig. When they sit down finally on the bed, his mood changes and he tells her an extraordinary thing. She can't decide whether it's just a speech or something he really feels, something he tells only her. He says, "I'm doing this for the black man and the Latino man and the American Indian, for the working people like your father and all the other fathers who send their boys to Southeast Asia for no reason anybody can explain to them, just out of their goodness and their faith in the country, for the unwed mother in Chicago who's raising her sister's kids too, who gets by on a welfare check and 5 swing shifts a week at the Uniroyal plant in Gary. Those are the people I'm going to help. Those are the people I'm doing this for. Those are the ones." He's a hero, she decides. Takes his strength and gives it to the country. Those strong arms and that voice and that mind that turns her around on a string sometimes like the mobile in her dentist's office. He hasn't said this to anybody else yet. That's what she decides. And he looked at her face right after he finished saying it. Her face. He turned to her as he sat on the bed. She remembers that so clearly because this was really something he should have been saying standing up. That's how good it was. And something changed in his face as he knotted his tie and jerked it straight in the collar. Was it her own look? She's tried and tried, but for the life of her, she can't remember whether she smiled. Another section about 20 pages later. And then what happens to her? What is this extraordinary moment with a United States senator finally due to her? The next morning she feels a little pit in her gut. Nothing big, maybe just needs a little breakfast, that's all, coffee. But afterward it's still there, and as she sets the cup on the counter to dry, she feels it again, this time a little stronger, a little tiny stone. Resentment. That's what it is. Clear as day, what's the matter with her? She's tried to help people all her life, and so has he, and what could be wrong with that? But it's there. She feels it again as she waits for him that night at the Pines, watching TV until almost 11:30 when she finally hears his tires on the gravel. That's what it is now, a cold little stone low in her belly. She hopes it won't show in her face. When she hears the car door close, she smiles at the mirror and goes to answer the short, short, long knock. It disappears when they make love. The stone melts. It goes back into her veins. But in the morning, still at the Pine, she stays in bed a little longer than she should, reading the paper, and it comes back. It starts in the front of her mind, and she can make herself think of something else, but soon it's there again, even when she's not thinking about it. A little sour flicker just before she starts another article, just before she turns on the hot water in the shower, just before she gets out of the Gremlin and McBain and Sweeney for work. It's there when she says good morning to Mr. McBain, and even when she smiles at the janitor she likes with a war limp, a Negro man like one of the ones Henry Bonwiller wants to help. It's there again when she waits at the Pines that night. I'm doing this for the black man and the Latino man and the American Indian. So why does that upset her? But it does, and it panics her too because it won't go away. And she doesn't understand. Why should it sour her that he wants to help all those people in need? Louis Lefkowitz wouldn't do anything for any of them, and she hates Louis Lefkowitz. So then what is so bitter in her that this is what she feels whenever Henry Bonwiller says his brave and extraordinary things? But it is. This chilly little stone attached inside her. People must see it on her face. It's not there every minute exactly, but it comes right back as soon as she is called upon to produce anything from inside herself, a word or a smile or even a hand on a shoulder. The bitterness comes out alongside it like some foul glue stuck to everything. At the worst times, mornings usually, speaking is actually starting to become a trick, speaking normally and not showing what's inside her. She checks her expression in windows and car mirrors. She checks it in her compact while pretending to remove a new ream of typewriter paper from the bottom drawer. Driving, she makes up little conversations. Hi, she says, good morning. Good morning to you. One afternoon at work, she hears a client at Mr. McBain's doorway say the name Bonwiller. She draws up straight, slips a piece of paper silently into the platen of her Selectric. That slime ball, the man says. She stiffens, pretends to study the letter she's about to type. How a guy can be in everybody's pocket at once, I don't know. The niggers and the unions and the oil companies, what a combo. Well, I don't know about that, Frank, Mr. McBain says in a skillful voice from inside the door. Yeah, the man says, well, why is nobody trying to help me? That's it, she thinks. She rolls the paper into the platen and begins to type. And for a few moments at least, she's cured. Why is nobody trying to help her? This is actually a much earlier scene. Another one of those scenes that has something of a ironic relevance to this current Democratic primary race that occurred this year, if any of you remember the race. On the afternoon of February 26th, and this is 1972. On the afternoon of February 26, I know the date because I've read the history, I was in the downstairs atrium putting together position papers for the statewide, position sheets for the statewide papers, when I heard a whooping shout from the upstairs study. It sounded like Henry Bonwiller. And a moment later, Mr. Metairie. Presently, the door opened and the senator leaned out. He came to the hallway railing next to where the Secret Service man sat reading the paper and looked down. When he saw nobody but me, he said, well, shoot, get up here right now, boy. What is it, sir? Got some good news. Get up here before you miss it. That morning, I'd taken the bus home from Dunleavy. Dunleavy is the prep school where the Metairies send this kid to. It's a boarding school. Utterly unlike anything the boy has known. That morning, I'd taken the bus home from Dunleavy, fearing that this weekend with the campaign was going to be my last. I'd begun to steel myself to finishing out the year, too, using my weekends to get ahead of my classes until it was warm enough for soccer. Henry Bonwiller now trailed Muskie by 13 points. Aberdeen West was at a fraction of its normal capacity, and the bustle of all the reporters, which had given the house a constant air of anticipation, had dwindled to almost nothing. Mrs. Metairie was gone, so were Christian and Clara, and most of the campaign staff had driven north to Nashua and Manchester for a final push before most of them, no doubt, would switch to McGovern now, or maybe Muskie. The marble entrance halls echoed. I climbed the stairs and entered the library. There was no one there but Mr. Metairie and the senator. On TV, Walter Cronkite was talking about the trial of Angela Davis that was set to begin in California. "Change the station," the senator said. "It's got to be in one of them by now." Leah Metairie did. First, he turned to ABC, where Harry Reasoner was speaking outside a banquet hall in Peking. No, that's not it. I know that, Henry suggested Metairie. "I'm looking." "It's Muskie," the senator went on, turning to me. Might have been the first time he'd ever addressed me outside the car other than to give me an order. "We just got a call. Some dinky newspaper ran a piece about his wife. Says she smokes and drinks." "It was the union leader," said Mr. Metairie from the TV. He changed the channel again. "The Manchester union leader. They say Jane Muskie smokes and drinks and tells dirty jokes. Ha, ha, ha." He bumped me on the shoulder with a scotch glass, then took a drink. "Well, who doesn't?" he bellowed. "And now look at what the guy does." He turned to Leah Metairie. "You found it yet?" "I'm still looking, Henry." On the screen now, a commercial was ending. Then David Brinkley came on. This was NBC. "Jesus Christ, Almighty God," said Henry Bonwell. And he pulled me by the arm until I was right next to him in front of the TV. "Watch this boy." The picture is muffled by snow. Not by static, but by real snow, which is falling heavily in Manchester that day. Edmund Muskie is standing on the bed of a truck in front of the union leader offices, where as the snow swirls around him, he proceeds to defend the honor of his wife against William Loeb, the paper's publisher. "He's talking about the drinking, the dirty jokes," Henry Bonweller said, bumping my arm again with a glass. "That Loeb's a son of a bitch, all right. Worse than the rat fuckers who feed him. But if I know Jane Muskie, he'd better talk faster." "Shh," said Leah Metairie. "Here it comes." Then, in the middle of it, as David Brinkley begins to narrate, Senator Muskie suddenly appears to break down. In the thickening snowfall, the picture is hard to discern. The camera moves in. He's recovered now and is shaking his fist in the air, but then it happens a second time. He convulses for a moment, and at this point there's no doubt. He's crying on national television. "Come on," Henry Bonwiller nearly shouted. "Did you see that? Did you see that?" "Yes, sir." "He does it again, boy. Keep watching." And he does. 1 week before the primary. "Get the scotch, Liam, the good stuff." "Well, it does look promising for us, Henry," said Mr. Metairie. He turned to me. "Promising? That horse been rode hard and put to bed wet. That's the end of him, son, right there." He ran his finger across his throat. "Period. End of poem." He rose and slapped Mr. Metairie on the back. "Let's have a drink to this fine day of hunting. Give the boy a drink, Liam." He pulled a bottle of Glenlivet from the cabinet and poured a glass. "Here," he said, "do not go gentle into this good night." "I don't think Corey's ever tasted scotch," said Mr. Metairie. "Nonsense," said Henry Bonwiller. "It's all I drank at his age." "To President Bonwiller, then," said Leah Metairie. "To President Bonwiller," I repeated, holding up my drink. "Oh, I like that," he roared. He raised his own tumbler of scotch to the ceiling, then followed it with his eyes like a man having a vision. "To President Bonwiller," he said softly. Then he lowered his arm, and at that moment, as though instead of a glass in his hand, he'd been holding a wand, phones began ringing all over the house. That's all I'm going to read, unless I request anything else. I'd love to talk about anything, politics, books, writing.
I have a question about how you picked the political year that you picked to write the story, and then related to that is what it was like to mix real politics with the fictional.
Yeah.
You know, you took a campaign with real characters in you.
Nothing is intentional. It is entirely a struggle. I have no idea. Every morning it's the hardest thing I can imagine. I can't even get into my office. There's like a physical force field around it. I don't know why I picked 72. I think because it was my first political memory. I was 12 years old. I carried a UNICEF can for George McGovern around. And, you know, God bless people who gave a 12-year-old money for a presidential candidate. I mean, I certainly wouldn't now. I'd say, you know, let me see your parents. Let me talk to your parents. But that was sort of my first political memory. And those years, 12 and 13 years old, were sort of the years I can remember what songs were playing. You know, that's when I first was kissing girls. And it's just this deeply sort of – so it was nothing political about that. I mean, in retrospect, I can say that, you know, Nixon was probably the beginning of the current era in politics. He was the master that has informed all politics since then. But that's just all sort of putting a gloss on something that was inadvertent. And, you know, some reviewers have brought the analogy to Ted Kennedy. Chappaquiddick was 1969. And I did read something about Chappaquiddick. And, of course, Kennedy is sick now. And God knows I love what he's done. I don't know anybody's politics here, but I love what he's done in so many ways. But he is a complicated man. You know, you look back at that moment, if you read enough about Chappaquiddick, nobody knows what happened. And that's what this book is sort of to me. But it's also about a number of other politicians. Henry Bonneau gives Joe Allen Charney Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, which I didn't know this, but that's what Bill Clinton gave Monica Lewinsky. I didn't know that till a couple of days ago. So it's – did you all know that? Yeah, I did not know that. In fact – give her what? A Vox, oh yeah, sort of pornographic, hyper detailed, interesting. So all men are the same, basically. Some just are. And it's interesting to me that I had never read All the King's Men, a very similar plot. I still haven't read An American Tragedy. So I think if you just something just interesting about politics and something interesting about what drives people into that business, and we will never get a normal human being in those offices. We can only hope that we get a public-minded monster. Really, yeah. And
from your own autobiography, we know you spent time over in the physical sciences and science land.
Right.
Then you found your way back to the humanities and literature land. Now right. You're in the middle of social science land. How does it feel when you're in these different paradigms? Most of us get stuck in one or the other.
I don't think I'm in the social science. I think I'd still be in the humanities literature side of things. How does it feel to be in no man's land?
Well, no. When you're in these different realms, do you always feel a calling back to being the author? Or
yeah.
How did it feel during these different periods?
Yeah, it was a relief. I mean, I was always on those personality tests that my wife loves, those ENFP things. I'm always right down the middle, XXXX. And I've always been that way. And when I started out in college, I was a physics major. I thought anybody interested in anything else was just not smart enough to be a physics major. That's what it seemed like to me. And if anybody was interested in art or literature, it was just soft-headed. And then I read a book that I loved called The Stories of John Cheever. And just after that, from that day on, I wanted to be a writer. When I was in medical school, it was sort of a way out because I knew that I was only half there. I still wanted to be a writer, so it kind of protected me emotionally from the rigors of that and the fact that, you know, you really had to work. So I didn't write much before I got to medical school. I got to medical school and I wrote a lot because I wasn't supposed to be writing. And since then, I've looked for reasons to make myself not supposed to be writing. And I think that it helped. You got to feel like a little bit of a rebel in your life. And, you know, how many times can you change? I want to change one more time maybe, but that's getting scary now that I have three children.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious about what your view of history is and whether or not that influenced the way you wrote this novel. One approach to history is that individuals in powerful positions make a big difference in control. And the other is that it's a series of dynamics, events, et cetera, that control.
That's probably – it's so funny that you asked that. Are you a historian or
– No, I'm not a historian, although I was a history major.
It's funny that you asked that because that was sort of the central question that started me on this book. What does it come down to? Is it just the personality of Lyndon Johnson in that office that day that did it? Was it the force of personality? Is that it? And the older I get, the more I lean in that. Well, I don't know. And as I say that, I start to lean the other way. I don't know because in my own lifetime, I've been in the midst of two historical waves that I was old enough to witness. One was the dot-com thing that I was living in California, and you could feel it like a wave. It picked you up, and it changed everything. And now I'm sad to say, or I suppose I'm worried to say, it feels like we are in the wave of a declining empire, and that wave is crashing, and we're going to hit that sand. Mm-hmm. I do not know if that's going to happen. I personally think that there's a great opportunity in green technology for a sort of a second, like microchip mini revolution that we are, I hope, not going to waste. But I do feel that now so I've seen two historical waves, and I hope I see a third that brings us back up. But that was the central question that got me thinking about it. Is it just the guy? Mm-hmm. Is it just the charisma? Mm-hmm. Is it just the personal charisma of men and women in rooms that change history? I don't know. That's my answer. All right. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.